Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network since 2009. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
All right, welcome back to Saved by the Bellini, the podcast. I am John DeBerry, and this is the podcast where we take a behind-the-scenes look at my cocktail book, Saved by the Bellini, which is a love letter to the 90s as told through a couple dozen cocktail recipes. And this series is sort of dedicated to the people who had an influence, large, small, direct, indirect, on the production of this book. And it's very fitting that for the final interview of this series, we're talking to Jim Meehan, who is who's my boss, and he has been a mentor for me for 15 or so years, and so much of how I work as a professional and you know, the things I value are a direct result of his influence. And every cocktail I create, everything I write kind of has some level of DNA thanks to him. And so I wanted to bring him on because he actually also did bartend in the 90s. And so I got a really cool look at sort of how people think of the 90s as being this dark time for cocktails, but Toby's interview really dispelled that and kind of rehabilitated the 90s a little bit in terms of like the mixology of it all. And so I brought Jim on to talk about what his experience was like bartending. And it turns out that it's actually really surprising that, you know, drinks were actually weren't that bad in the 90s. I think it actually got a bad rap. And so I learned a lot actually talking to Jim, even though we've, you know, talked at length for decades. And I hope that you'll enjoy this conversation as well. Thanks for listening.
Okay, so hi, Jim. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me.
I'm honored to be here, John.
Likewise, I'm honored that you're here. The reason why I'm bringing people like you and Julie and Toby on to this podcast is because, you know, I'm trying to sort of like explore the deeper world of the book that I just wrote, Saved by the Bellini. And it's both an exploration of like the 90s, as a pop culture kind of period, but then a little bit of like some drinks that sort of feel 90s-ish, as well as like some explicitly very 90s drinks like the Appletini and like other, you know, other kind of like sort of lowbrow things like that. And something that I'm finding really interesting is to hear about how cocktail culture and kind of craft cocktails are sort of seen as being really like the, you know, the dark ages were the 90s, and then at kind of in the early 2000s and then onward, it was sort of this like golden age of this renaissance of craft cocktails. And I'm kind of trying to see how true that really was. And so when I saw that you, you mentioned that you were a bartender in the 90s, and since you're such a, you've been a mentor of mine for 15 years at least, that I thought it would be great to talk to about, you know, someone who was kind of, quote, like, you know, there kind of in the trenches in the 90s. And then also like as, you know, the kind of this craft cocktail revival started to formulate in the early 2000s, you were also there. So I'm just really curious to hear, what your take on, you know, 90s cocktail culture is. And kind of what your memories are of it.
Yeah, it's funny. First of all, congratulations on the book.
Thanks.
I was so excited to receive it. And your second publisher is the publisher of my first book. And they do such a great job of making kind of beautiful packages. And you know, I'm a sucker for art. And so I'm really... When I received the book, I knew it would be great because you wrote it, but I'm really enjoying spending time with it. And I just think it's fun.
Thank you.
I think that is when I think of the 90s, both my time drinking in bars and working in bars, it was really a lot of fun. Right. And aside from the sort of gastronomy of beverage that we sort of, you know, that most of my career is focused on in this century, the last century, my experience at the end of it as a young adult was I had a lot of fun, and the drinks were not very serious, mostly, really none of them. And it was fun. I will say, and I imagine Toby probably mentioned it, that there, this idea that the Dark Ages were pitch black is incorrect. Like there were, I'm sure Toby would have mentioned the using fresh juices in the pre-2000. And I worked at a bar in Madison, Wisconsin in the 90s called Cafe Momar, which had a classic focused cocktail menu that used fresh juices. So it was probably one of the only places in town that you could get a drink like that, but it was there and it was quite popular among a small group of people. So I think that's definitely something that I imagine your other guests will point out, is that it was dark in a, if you apply some of today's logic and values to the 90s,
right.
It was dark, but it wasn't pitch black.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's easy to, for me, in my own like chauvinism of living in New York and learning to bartend at PDT in 2007 or 2008, that, like, you know, the fact that there was a craft cocktail bar in Madison, Wisconsin at all is kind of surprising. And the fact that even like in the 90s we're doing like fresh juice. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you used the key word craft cocktail. The 90s had the cigar bar was kind of a thing in the 90s, as well as swing dancing was a thing in the 90s.
And I remember this, swing dancing.
And so I think that this, the swing dancing, the swing dancing sort of era brought back this retro vibe. So these drinks weren't craft in the 90s. They were considered retro.
Right. That's interesting. So, you know, when you're talking about this, like kind of the way the cocktail culture was back in the 90s, where was, like, you know, now we have like a million cocktail books. We've got like 20,000 YouTube channels, TikTok, everything. You know, we have like a lot of like structures for maintaining and disseminating kind of cocktail culture. But like, where were people getting their, like, kind of their ideas, and where were the big texts, you know, of cocktails in the 90s that instructed people, that said like fresh juice is better, you know, these are the right ingredients and these are the right recipes. Like where were people relying on? Like, what was the Bible?
Honestly, the book that was behind every bar that I worked in the 90s was the Mr. Boston's Bar.
Yeah. And
it's why, you know, when I got the opportunity to edit it, you know, back around 2004 or 5 with Anthony Giglio, that I jumped at it, is that it was like a telephone book. You know, it wasn't really, it didn't focus your attention. It was just all of the numbers of all the people that you could possibly ever want to call, you know? So I think that the answer to that really was there wasn't a book like that.
Right.
And the way that you found out about either what was going on or the way that you learned was by either going to bars and seeing people doing something, or really by being trained by somebody. So I would say that was the most culinary thing that I saw going on in the 90s, was just sort of the affection for all of the vodka infusions that were used for martini programs. I mean, in the 90s, especially the late 90s, the big fad was martini bars. And
right.
You would go to, I mean, that was the bleeding edge of cocktail innovation, was going to a martini bar that had 100 different martinis on the menu, of which very few of them had gin or any vermouth in them. They were just sort of different colored
Vodka drinks, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, Toby mentioned that too, about, you know, the highlight of a lot of 90s you know, craft culture, craft cocktail programs was like just jars and jars and jars of infusions into vodka.
Yep. And it would be like a big jar in the same way that, you know, maybe 5-10 years ago, you would go to a bar and they would have a couple different barrel ages, you know, like either Negronis or things that being used for a barrel aged Negroni. The barrel aged Negroni of the 90s was like a chili pepper infused vodka that was being used for a martini or for a Bloody Mary on, you know, for brunch or something like that. Like it was, that was the culinary leading edge of the 90s. And I think that, I mean, before I get in front of this conversation, I would just say that I've thought about the like major sort of tectonic plates of my career before the cocktail renaissance and after. And I think that two main historical changes that have changed bartending really forever between the two edges is really the iPhone coming out in 2007, which really sort of, none of my life before that really is well photographed or certainly not on any sort of video or, you know, is not documented, where I feel like the technology of phones today is such that people documenting every single element of their lives on their phones now is just sort of, it's part of every important event and ritual.
It's so normal.
And I would say, and that has changed bars and has changed bartending forever. And I think the other big one, which doesn't get talked about a lot, is the 2003 smoking ban that Michael Bloomberg put up in New York, which led to smoking bans across the country and eventually led to sort of smoking being banned in bars. And I think as someone who worked in very, very, very smoky bars throughout the 90s and up until that point, that so much of going to bars pre-2003 smoking ban was smoking.
Yeah.
And I would say what went along with smoking was and connects to the iPhone is that so much of going to bars before these two events was mating. And I think bars were places that people went to find other people to mate with.
Right.
And so I think that like, it's hard, I imagine, for young bartenders to imagine it today, but like the amount of time bartenders now, the luxury we have to spend thinking about our beverages is just not a mind share that I had in the 90s. My time in the 90s was spent probably somewhat equally between cleaning ashtrays and lighting and servicing cigarettes, serving drinks, and then dealing with the insane amount of mating rituals that were going on in my bar, some of which were not going well and needed intervention. And so I think that those three sort of activities, beverage service, smoking mitigation, and you know, sort of lighting and cleaning services, and then dealing with a wide variety of meeting and greeting going on, some of which was going well and some of which wasn't going well, was what bartending was for me pre sort of 2007. And is, I think Tinder and the sort of dating apps have all changed, and the phone really has changed between the smoking going away and now the iPhone taking over. I now really am like a one trick pony. You know, I'm a beverage person. I'm a specialist.
I want to ask you some more about that, but we're going to take a quick break and be right back in a sec.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City, Long Island, and Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Okay, and we're back with Jim Meehan. Jim, before the break, you were talking about how kind of like what the role of a bartender sort of evolved into what it is now, kind of at the cusp of the, you know, kind of Y2K millennium with regards to like smoking and kind of like bars being a hookup place, and also the phone, really kind of the smartphone, really like making it so that you could document drinks and sort of share them around. That's what you meant by the phone, right? Like how, you know, you go to a bar and now you take a picture, you tag the bartender, and then it's everywhere. Whereas, you know, in 2002 or 1997, you didn't really have that ability. You had to like have a little point and shoot camera, and the people who were able to see that were very low.
Yeah, I think it's that, but it's actually also, I remember one time talking with someone as I like walked into a bar, and I looked at a bar and the bar was filled with people staring into their phones mm-hmm. instead of talking to each other or talking to the bartender. And I think it was either the bartender or the person that I was with remarked that the only way to get these people's attentions is through their phones. Right. And so I would say, in addition to the phone being used as where you find your next mate or how to document your experience, the phone is now the entertainment in publicly and privately. Whereas in bars previous to this, you would go to a bar and you would either feel obliged to speak to the people around you,
yeah.
or you would use the bartender as the concierge to facilitate that. That has now disappeared.
So it's like the role of the bartender evolved from more of like a social connector and kind of like maintenance of the space to someone who actually, you know, does like quote mixology, to use a word that probably not everyone loves, but I find very useful. I think yeah. the word mixology has been around for hundreds of years, but I think that the idea of the bartender being the kind of site of culinary action versus the kind of person who's taking care of the space is a really interesting one to think about when it comes to like what bartending was like in the 90s and kind of how drinking culture evolved since then.
We were like bees pollinating flowers, I feel like, back then. You know, maybe not all of them were flowers, but
right.
and certainly we did sting some people, but it was much more interactive back then. And now I feel like one of the biggest challenges bartenders and operators face is how to create an environment that's stimulating enough to get people to put their phone down sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that is a legitimate challenge given how highly functional our phones are now.
Right. They're very interesting to look at.
There's a lot on them.
There's a lot on there. Yeah, it's true. So when you think about like the 90s in terms of like what kind of drinks you were making, I mean, it seems like you were working at a place of somewhat of an outlier with regards to just like the amount of kind of quote craft that was involved in that program. But like when you think about like kind of stereotypical like hallmark cocktails of the 90s, like what comes to mind?
It's funny, when I speak to bartenders now about the 90s, I usually preface my remarks that like the sort of drinks I made literally would be subjects for inquiries of sexual harassment. So many of the drinks that we made were so lewd. Like their names were lewd, their concepts were lewd. They were obscene. And so I would say that the first bar I worked at, State Street Broth, which is still there in Madison, we served a lot of lewd shots and sort of drinks like the swamp water, the Long Island iced tea, or the Alabama Slammer, you know, sort of. And then I quickly graduated from, not quickly, I was there for a couple years, but after 2.5 years, I moved up up State Street to a bar called Paul's Club, which was more of a craft beer bar that like people drank, you know, sort of gin and tonics or more classic drinks. That bar I talked about, Cafe Mumar, was the one that was the outlier that served classic cocktails. But I would say that generally speaking, I didn't work in a martini bar in the 90s. I worked at these sort of craft beer or like, sort of, if you can imagine, 1987, I think, is when Bombay Sapphire and I think Bombay Sapphire came out around 97. I think Patron came out around 87.
Okay.
So like by the 90s, these sort of like small, like these gin and bourbon are starting to become popular in a very novel sense.
Yeah. And what was it about? I mean, it seems like they're like the 90s were also kind of exemplified by the ubiquity of vodka.
Yeah.
What do you think? Why do you think that was?
I think that the advertising, I mean, obviously the like ad age of Mad Men was more in the 50s and 60s, but I think that the 90s and late 80s were this like sort of John Cusack, like post John Cusack sort of like glossy, like really, I mean, I guess the Wolf of Wall Street would be the sort of, right, modern sort of visualization of this conspicuous consumption culture that was driven by this like glossy Madison Avenue style of consumption that was sort of epitomized by the absolute advertising campaigns. Mm. So I think that I think that vodka marketing, especially the Absolute ads, were iconic, and that I think that the zeitgeist of that time was really fueled through Hollywood and through the sort of kind of playboy bad boy imagery that you saw in movies and on TV and in sports. These were the Jordan era mm-hmm. of basketball. I don't know for any of your listeners who went back and watched that great documentary about the Jordan era of basketball, but it was quite a heady time. And I think that people, it was also like George Bush was president. I mean, there's plenty of reasons to want to need to look for a strong drink.
Right. And so vodka kind of was popular because it was like a high proof, something you could just get a cocktail that was like strong as opposed to like a beer or a wine. Or
yeah, I mean, honestly, I've always felt that you know, as I've thought about why people drink cocktails, I think that cocktails, there are many reasons why people drink cocktails, but I think that one of the functions they serve is this form of mirroring where people drink a drink that like either reflects their actual mood or their desired mood. They function as these identifying signifiers that really sort of allow people to like either be themselves or be an idealized version of themselves.
Right.
And I feel like certain drinks have such strong identities. Like when you order a Bloody Mary or a mojito or a margarita, you can't really impose your own identity on that drink because it has such a strong identity of its own. So when you drink that, you're like leaning into the identity of what that is. Yeah. Whereas when you order something more novel, like that doesn't have such a strong identity, or that's made with something like vodka that has really very little character, I think it functions more like a canvas that allows you to impose a little bit more of yourself into it. So I think that there's a certain amount, without getting too like sort of philosophical, there's a certain amount of narcissism that goes into a vodka drink because it's just you sort of it's nothing. It requires you to add personality to it, and right. I think that was part of its allure back then.
Like the blank canvas was sort of like
the blank canvas that you could paint on, yeah,
exactly.
With your own personality, your own moods, your own. What you wanted it to mean for you.
You project your own hopes and dreams on it.
Yeah.
I'm also really curious about like this kind of pivotal turning point that seemed to be have occurring in the late 90s and then sort of that launched this craft cocktail revival. Because if you think about like Flatiron Lounge and Pegu Club and Death and Company, and then even Milk and Honey, I think it was opened in 2000 and 2001, you know, was, and it's kind of easy to frame it in terms of like a, maybe a backlash. But to me, it seems like this was sort of like the 90s were almost laying the groundwork for this sort of thing. And it just was this momentum moment. And the idea of what a bartender did began to change. And then with that came these new bars that were really focusing on cocktails as like a culinary art form and not just like a vehicle for alcohol, essentially. When, you know, between the years of, you know, being in Wisconsin and then opening PDT in 2007, like what, like, I mean, do you see yourself as playing a role in that kind of that pivot, or what was going on at that time that was like led to where we are today, basically, which is like where, you know, you can get a Negroni on an airplane and it's good.
I would say that it's interesting now that we've had enough time to look back on this,
right.
I think that we can develop new narratives or new interpretations of what was happening and why it happened. I would say that for myself, I moved to New York 9 months after 9/11 at a time when the city itself was still really sort of rebuilding after 9/11, and the hospitality industry was absolutely devastated by the events of 9/11. And so as I think back upon my experience in New York, I think about, you know, for instance, like COVID, you know, what just happened to the hospitality industry during COVID, and, you know, to a lesser extent, you know, looking at PDT opened in 2007, right in the midst of the financial crash.
I know. Yeah.
And I think that if we think about sort of like these, you know, 9/11, 2007 financial crisis, the COVID crisis that we hopefully are almost over, there's almost like a sense of like, there's like a forest fire where the fire destroys the forest, but there's this rebirth that happens afterwards in this period of renewal that comes after a fire. I feel like as I look back on this, there's a lot going on. You know, I think some of it is this idea of birth and renewal. I think some of it is thinking about the how there's a culinary, really a sort of like wine and beer and culinary renaissance that goes back to, you know, Alice Waters and California cuisine that was very much going on as well on the East Coast, and the way cocktails became culinary in a market driven way, kind of stemming from these more culinary martini menus. But I also think as we think about the specific bars like Milk and Honey and then Pegu Club and Flatiron Lounge in particular, and Employees Only as well, is I think that like what Sasha unfortunately isn't here to speak for what he intended or for how he went about this. But as I think about it more and more, and especially reflect back on the role Angel Share played on Sasha, I begin to think that really in many ways, what we called a sort of modern speakeasy in Milk and Honey was really a Tokyo Ginza bar that was fashioned along the lines of Angel Share, you know, and in many ways we almost got that wrong. And because of that, you know, bars like say maybe PDT or Death and Company or sort of bars that were either straight speakeasies or were sort of nodded to it like Employees Only did, they missed the origin point of it, and or at least the media did. And I think that if we think about Milk and Honey as a Tokyo Ginza style bar instead of a neo speakeasy, I begin to wonder what that all would mean as we unspool history from that thread. I also think that I think that as we stand here today, obviously the the role of, say, Julie Reiner and Audrey Saunders and Sasha, and the sort of, I think that there was like a pairing between these lounges that were very much bars that had some food mm-hmm. versus restaurants. Like WD50 was a restaurant that opened right around the time I moved to New York.
Yeah.
And I think about the cocktail program there, and I think about cocktail programs at other restaurants nationwide, whether Taylor. It be, you know, at Alinea with Grant Atkins, or at Drink with Barbara Lynch, or at Slanted Door in San Francisco. I think that restaurants and chefs, you know, Violet Hour with Paul Kahn, I think about a lot of great cocktail bars that sort of paved the way for where we are today were incubated in restaurants, you know, Holman and Finch with Greg Best and Linton Hopkins. They were restaurant bar programs, certainly what you did after PDT with David Chang at Momofuku. And I think that we mostly focus on the bars and the lounges. So I think that there are numerous sort of threads we can pull on as we think of the narrative. And I think the story is actually way more complex than it's been told yet.
Definitely.
You know?
Well, I feel like I've exhausted all of my 90s questions for you, Jim.
I guess I have some 90s questions for you. I mean, one of the first
things
ahead. I thought when I read this book was like, how old was John in the 90s? Like, I guess my questions for you looking at, I mean, I know in my post for the book, I immediately thought that that Gizmo was on the cover, and someone on my post was like, I think that's a Furby.
Furby. So
it was funny. Like I guess I was working and I was like in college in my 20s in the 90s. What was it like for you to write this book? What was it like? Like, what have you learned from the 90s?
That's a great question. And I'm glad this is getting inverted into interviewing me.
I have one more question after this.
Too. Okay. That's great. We have no time limit. So for me, the 90s were really interesting because, you know, I'm part of this generation of people that can sort of has a very clear memory of what life was like before the internet, but also like was sort of native to the internet. So like, I remember, you know, I was basically, you know, 9 years old, wait, no, 8 years old. I turned eight, had just turned eight when the clock struck 1990, and then I was basically I turned 19 in 2000. So it was a very pivotal decade for me. I feel like there was a parallel between like the ascendancy of the internet and this kind of acceleration of our culture that sort of coincided with my own kind of coming into consciousness. And you know, I obviously have memories of the 80s, but like, kind of where I became who I was that decade. And so it was really interesting to place a lot of these cultural artifacts, if you will, in this context of like the 90s were the decade that kind of defined the 21st century and it laid the groundwork for the world that we're living in now. And so I saw that kind of reflected in like, you know, my adolescence was the 90s, and that's where you kind of form who you are as a person for the rest of your life to a certain extent. So seeing that kind of parallel was really cool. I knew I didn't drink. I mean, I think I had some Kahlua. I think I may have had a mind eraser in the year 2000. But like, as far as like drinking, I never went to a cocktail bar. Like I didn't really drink until I was like 18, 19 for the most part, except for like furtive, you know, sips of wine or maybe like a random vodka shot here and there when I was like in high school. But I didn't have the 90s cocktail knowledge to be able to speak authoritatively about what it was like to drink in the 90s. So I knew that was just sort of I had to avoid that and really just talk about these other, you know, non-drink things and then find a way to make drinks that are related and that are inspired by those things so that there's not a sense of me being like, oh, I'm going to tell you what drinking was like in the 90s, because I wouldn't be able to do that. So I think I learned a lot about kind of like where, like myself, and you know, these are the kinds of the things that I picked for the book, and these are the kinds of things that kind of made me who I was, and things that I still enjoy. And sort of placing that in sort of more of a broader context kind of makes you feel a little bit more, maybe a little bit more important. And like, you know, as someone who's like never not going to have children, you know, it's kind of like a way of sort of placing yourself within history in a way that feels kind of comforting.
Yeah, I have to say, as I was thinking about, you know, this interview, but also this, you know, opportunity, so much of the 90s, I was in the library because I was taking college classes, and then I worked my way through college. So when I wasn't in the library or in class, I was at work. So in some ways, like I didn't recognize that the Furby gizmo at like adjacent toy was because like I did. What was very interesting to me when I opened your book and started reading through and looking at a lot of it is I didn't recognize a lot, and it really kind of hit me like a ton of bricks that I spent the 90s either in a library, you know, reading about literature, or at a bar during an era where, like, you know, the Packers were and the Badgers were constantly winning Super Bowls or Rose Bowls, or like I was so busy with life that the culture of the 90s, I didn't have time to go to movies or watch TV or like sort of really sort of let the zeitgeist of the 90s really affect what I was thinking about or doing. So as I've like looked and like, I guess it brings me to my second question, which I think you answer in the book, but I'll let you speak to it, is that I feel like obviously as bar operators and bartenders, we work a little bit like fashion designers or stylists, where we're constantly like looking to different eras of history to sort of use for inspiration for our cocktails or our cocktail programs. And I think that the 90s has been this like third rail where, or like really more the 70s and 80s, but for instance, like when Greg Bohm opened Golden Cadillac with Giuseppe, I was just like, please do not open this Pandora's box of terrible cocktails, you know, back up, because we all saw what happened to the industry when this became the dominant form of drinking, is that people eventually just stopped drinking cocktails. And I think that part of my concern I'm usually like, everything you do, the first thing I think of is, oh my gosh, what's John doing now? And then I have to like pinch myself and be like, well, it's John. I'm sure he's going to figure the smart way to do this. So my first concern when I found out you were doing a 90s book was, oh my gosh, please don't make the 90s drinks popular again. But as I like look through your book, while the zeitgeist is the 90s, the drinks are very modern in many ways. Like they're playful in a 90s way, but they definitely aren't regressively retro. They aren't vulgar. They're actually really sort of smart while honoring the zeitgeist. How did you sort of square that circle, or how did you polish that turd?
That's a good question. It's funny because I was on Dave Arnold's podcast a couple weeks ago, and he was like, your drinks are all completely off the rails. in a good way. That's a compliment coming from Dave Arnold. So, you know, for me, it's like the drink recipe, you know, it's like being so steeped in cocktail culture and, you know, having like the structure of all these drinks beaten into you, and like, this is what balances, and like, you want your drinks to be dry and tart and interesting. That was a sort of automatic. Like, it's hard for me to not make a drink that's sort of like in this like New York City mid-aughts, you know, PDT, Death and Company, Milk and Honey kind of style. But then when it came time to make drinks that were sort of like, it's almost like a way, like you're writing humor, where it's like, okay, I have this endpoint, I have this like punchline that I want to get to in this drink that relates to something that's outside of the drink. How do I then use the kind of tools to get there? And the kind of the way that the drinks end up being tasting is that they're balanced, that they're up to date, they use ingredients that, you know, people can find. But I usually had some pretty heavy outside parameter that made it like really like hard for me to deviate too far from the structure of like let's say like the Jurassic Park drink, you know, like life finds a way is this like is this iconic line from Jeff Goldblum. And so it's like, well, what's the culinary pun with whey? And it's well milk whey. And then it's like, right. Well, so you want to make a whey cocktail that also kind of talks about like Costa Rica, because the island in Jurassic Park is off the coast of Costa Rica. And so what are some like ingredients that you can find that make sense for all of that? So it's like rum and mango and pineapple, and you put it all in a blender. So like by giving myself these very like kind of rigid parameters, it became very easy to do something like unhinged, but very kind of disciplined.
That's what I love about it, is that it's very, the 90s weren't like that. They were just unhinged.
Yeah.
You know, like they were. So I feel like that's, I think that this book is fascinating because it's not, I think so many of us obviously were inspired by the, you know, the David Wunderliches or the sort of history has played such a huge role in the last 20 years of drinks and drinks books. And I like the way this book is both, it's very historical in a cultural sense, but it's ahistorical in the drink sense. And I think that was a surprise and delight element of this book, because I think that without like, you know, casting unnecessary aspersions on the 90s, it's like the 90s weren't interesting because the drinks were so good. Everything else was really interesting.
Right.
I think. And so I think that you've improved the drinks, but you've leaned into the culture in a way that is, I think that is really smart. You know, I think that there's so much, as you said, like this was like a sort of seminal moment in your life as you were kind of coming into adulthood. And I think that you are at a impressionable time in your life where you're able to sort of like soak it all in and synthesize it. And the way you toggle between like TV and toys and music and kind of food and sort of, you know, it's really sort of, it's fun and playful. And I think like your last book, I think that, as someone who's guilty of writing cocktail books that are not the most fun cocktail books that have ever been written, I think that you do a great job of sort of giving some levity to this genre of books without compromising their quality, you know, which a lot of writers unfortunately are just going for the clicks and could kind of care less about the craft.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that very high praise. I think it's actually a perfect place to end things. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks for having me on, John.
Yeah. Saved by the Bellini is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.